Hello, and welcome to the EduCause podcast. I'm Jerry Bain for EduCause, and you can find more podcasts like this by visiting connect.educause.edu. Just click on the podcast button near the top of the page, or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. On this podcast, we feature an interview with Michael Wesch, Assistant Professor of Cultural Anthropology at Kansas State University. Wesch has distinguished himself with unique perspectives on teaching and the use of multimedia in the classroom. In 2008, he was awarded the Case Carnegie U.S. Professor of the Year Award for doctoral and research universities. In this interview, we talk about collective intelligence, teaching in an age of budget cuts, and teaching in the cloud. I started our interview by asking Wesch to explain his current project on anonymity.
What the Anonymity Project is it's both a research project and a class, but it turns out for me that I think that the best way to teach a class is just to have a research project and get all the students involved in it. So basically, I've just recruited the, quote, students as research assistants or co-producers, you might say, and we're just going for it, you know. And so we decided from the beginning, we started brainstorming last semester even, like, on our topic, and we wanted to find something relevant and exciting, understudied, something that was small enough that it could foster collaboration, yet big enough that each person would have their own little piece of the project. And we chose anonymity for several reasons. And one of them is just, first off, to just address what I have called the crisis of significance that I see in my classroom. You know, like when I walk into a large lecture hall and the first sense you get is, you know, do the students really see any relevance in their education and what they're going to get out of this and that type of thing. And so there's a general sense of feeling anonymous in an environment like that. And I started looking into the history of that, you know, the history of disengagement in the classroom. And it turns out it goes very deep. And you can see a big run of discussion around this in the early 60s. Throughout the 60s, but also even going back to the 1920s and stuff. The second reason we chose anonymity was not just because of what we see in the classroom, the sort of anonymous feeling among students, but also we wanted to explore how anonymity is used online and the possibilities and consequences of this on community and identity. Online interaction just creates this possibility for anonymity, and we wanted to find out what the implications of that might be. So actually, a part of the project is looking at this group called Anonymous. I'm not sure if you've heard
of
them,
Scientology protest group.
Right. Well, that's like a certain wing of them. There's an interesting debate within this group, if you can call it a group, where some people feel like that's a little bit too serious of a endeavor for Anonymous, and the rest of the of people are just in it for the lulz, they say, like for the laughs. Mm-hmm. Lulz being a corruption of laugh out loud, LOL. So they're a fascinating group because if you go to, say, 4chan or something like that, where they meet, you know, this is one of their main community hubs, it is by default that everybody is anonymous on that page. So you have a community in which nobody has an identity. So that then leads to the third piece of this and why we chose anonymity, and that was because we also wanted to explore its opposite, and that is the sort of cult of celebrity that we live in today and the extreme focus on becoming famous that you see in American Idol and even on YouTube and things like that. So we thought all three of these things could come together in a really interesting way. And it's been really exciting already. You know, we've been looking at the history of these things, and you can see that this crisis of significance, this sort of loss of meaning in life and so on, goes back you know, several centuries, and you can see it with the rise of urbanization, which leads people to be literally, you know, one in a million and having the sense of being sort of lost in the crowd. Also with the rise of bureaucracy and industrialization, people have this sense of being an anonymous functionary. They have just this role to serve. And this has been expressed for quite some time, so that by 1926, there was actually an article written by Henry Canby, and it's called Anon is Dead. And he had noted that after 1850, basically most of the important works that were written were all claimed by an author, whereas before 1850, there were a lot of really important books that were written anonymously. And he said that he placed the blame for this change on, this sort of longing that had emerged, a longing to, what he said, this is a quote from him, to escape from the deadly anonymity of modern life, which generates a certain passion for non-anonymity. And he goes on and he says, the general man feels his personality sinking lower and lower into the whirl of indistinguishable atoms to be lost in a mass civilization. So already in the 1920s, there's a sense of loss of identity and a sort of cult of celebrity arising out of that. And of course, this all precedes television. But with television and the rising consumerism that we've seen throughout the 20th century, it just sort of increases this trend that we've seen. And so this has just become a really exciting project for us to contextualize our own lives. You know, I think that's what's exciting for the students, is to sort of putting their own lives into context and thinking about their own significance in the world.
Well, when are you going to tackle big questions? Well, what I find interesting about that, Mike, is the sense that this book was written in the 60s about feeling the anonymity of modern life creeping up. But
yeah.
Wouldn't this be a post-individualism kind of phase then? Because if you look at the Middle Ages and serfdom, there wasn't even a sense of individuality in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So there had to be that built up first, then to drift back into a sense of anonymity.
But what's interesting is that the individualism actually sort of goes along with anonymity. They actually kind of coincide and grow together, so that your sense of individualism, well, think of the phrase one in a million. It's
right.
Both a statement of anonymity, but it's also a statement of individualism. And so in a way, this goes back to some of the early social theory on this, like George Simmel noted that basically the larger your society, the larger a city or anything like that, you'll have a correlative rise in individualism.
Well, with the rise of viral videos and YouTube celebrities, how do you see this changing our attitudes towards fame in the new generations? I was telling a friend the other day, with the ability for everyone to record a music CD, there's really no more rock stars anymore.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that sort of trend of what the nature of fame is becoming.
Well, I think you're picking up on some really interesting trends. And, you know, it's hard to really pin it all down into one statement, but I really was sort of captured by Thomas de Zengotita's little analysis of this. I don't know if you've seen this book called Mediated, but he makes an argument there where he basically makes the argument that for several decades here, we've been in a celebrity culture dominated by TV, and that creates a world in which the fans are sort of at the whims of just celebrating the celebrities and never get to become the celebrities themselves. And so there they are sort of in their anonymity, becoming restless and wanting to get the same sort of attention that celebrities get. So he makes the argument that once, you know, YouTube and any sort of even public access television, things that created new platforms for people to sort of rush on stage, there are more than enough people willing to do that. And you can see it in reality TV. It seems that there's somebody who's willing to do just about anything to be on TV.
Absolutely.
And yeah. And so he has an interesting take on it. But there's another interesting thing that's going on, and that is that, you know, in our culture, we really want to protect our individuality. We admire our individuality. It's really a core value, I think, in our culture. At the same time, we sense a loss of community and want to seek connection. And I think that, you know, we see it on YouTube, people reaching out to connect with people while maintaining their individuality, because you can actually reach out through this sort of medium without giving up a whole lot of yourself in a way. Now, fame is actually, in a way, the ultimate way to do this, because it's a one-way relationship. It's a way of, if you become famous, then people love and admire you, but you actually don't have to, you know, have the same sort of energy loving them back. So I think that there's a certain way in which that can seem desirable. I think, though, that when people actually become famous, it's, you know, it's obviously, we've seen it happen over and over again. It sort of wrecks their life in a way.
Something you want until you get it, it seems.
Yeah. And I think that though the people seeking it, one of the things they're seeking really is just they want to be recognized very broadly. And, they, you know, it's sort of a counter to this anonymity that they feel in their everyday lives. Now, what's interesting, there's actually an interesting story here that ties in with another part of our project. With this group Anonymous, one of the things that they do is, because they have this community in which no identities exist, one of their core values is to completely go against this cult of celebrity. And they'll actually attack people if they feel like they are feeling more self-important than they really are, you know. Uh-huh. And they'll attack people online, anybody who sort of thinks that they're cooler than they should be or something like that. So for example, they've done attacks inside Second Life and on YouTube as well. On one of them, they went after John Edwards. John Edwards created a little thing inside Second Life to promote his 2008 campaign, and they went in and inside Second Life and basically ran a few scripts that created a situation in which feces and all kinds of stuff was thrown all over the Edwards campaign site. I don't know if you've heard about this.
No, I think I saw a little bit of footage in it in the trailer.
Yeah. Yeah. So some of the footage then was uploaded to YouTube so they could celebrate their attack. And the interesting thing though is that on the John Edwards blog, one of the anonymous people posted a statement which said, I'll just read from it here because I just found it the other day. He says, "As the internet has grown in popularity, a disturbing phenomenon has occurred. Everyone thinks they are special. We have news for you. You aren't special. You are a mindless horde of filth traversing the universe on a small ball of dirt, a speck upon a speck in the vastness of existence. We are here to remind you of this." And it goes on here, and it basically goes on to say that we, being anonymous, have accepted the fact that we are all just on this speck, just a speck upon a speck in the vastness of existence. And they go on to say things like, "We have no true names, we are anonymous, and our numbers are vast. We are everywhere, and we never forgive. Wherever someone takes themselves too seriously, we will be there. Wherever someone has an inflated ego, we will be there. We will do it through madness, and we will remove you from the high place you have built for yourself." And so it's kind of an interesting cultural inversion here. They've actually created a society that's completely identity free. And here, you know, if you think of what it is to be famous, it's sort of to have a very sort of an exploded identity or an expanded identity.
Right. And it seems to be a reaction against that.
Yeah. And it's a remarkable inversion that they've created. And one of the really beautiful things about this, I think, I mean, there's a lot of sort of ugly stuff that goes along with anonymous and anonymity online, but there's almost like an artistic beauty to what they do in some cases. So for example, that in sort of battling the cult of celebrity that is our culture, they sometimes help create celebrities out of the most unlikely people. And they can do this because their numbers are so vast and they have various computer skills that allow them to pump up YouTube numbers and that kind of stuff. So one of the things they did, or at least they're credited with doing, is, I don't know if you remember Tay Zonday's Chocolate Rain.
Of course.
One of the, you know, biggest viral videos, right, of last year. And a lot of that was actually driven by anonymous on 4chan. And they did it through a number of techniques where, you know, you can set up a little Firefox hack that reloads the YouTube page 199 times.
Oh, I see.
And then changes your IP and reloads it again 199 times. And because YouTube only accepts maybe like 200 views or something like that from each IP. And so they set up all of these types of little hacks to inflate the numbers. And the next thing you know, Tay Zonday is a star. And it just sort of allows them to create a mockery of our cult of celebrity. They recently did it again with a young teenage girl named Boxy. So if you look up Boxy, you'll see that she's, you know, sort of a less than willing YouTube star. Like all of a sudden she's a star herself.
Very interesting. I find it strange that I find it almost like counterproductive. It's if they're reacting against fame, are they just trying to sort of practice some chaos? Is that what they're trying?
Yeah, it's exactly what it is. I mean, what's so interesting is it's become this inversion of society. And yeah, that part of it is just creating chaos where there's order.
That's great.
Oh, you know, they're also the origin of the Rickroll. So the Rickroll that took off.
Oh, they started the Rickroll?
Right. Well, so the Rick Astley thing. So basically here they took a celebrity from the 80s who was way gone, you know, completely dead,
right,
and basically brought him back to life with the Rickroll. And that there's a long history of that. It started with the duck roll, which was just a sort of a thing where they'd trick you into clicking on a link, and then you go out and you click the link, and there would just be this animated GIF of a duck on wheels, and it was called the duck roll.
Uh-huh.
And that's where the Rickroll came from.
I guess we've had celebrities for forever, but it seems to have been sort of reached a critical mass in the last 10 years with people like Paris Hilton, Perez Hilton, Chris Crocker, etc. And I'm wondering if you see any sort of shift in attitudes of your students. Do you see anything in the younger generation that sort of this is a manifestation of in terms of?
Well, there's a lot to say about that. I mean, I think for one, every trend has its opposite in a way, you know, so that I think the Paris Hilton thing, the sort of celebrities who are famous for being famous, you know, that like they really haven't done anything except become famous, you know,
right, exactly.
It's this bizarre sort of empty celebrityness. And I think as we see that, we also see the counter trend, which is that it just becomes apparent to many students and young people that it's all sort of I think the fakeness of it all sort of becomes more apparent and more criticized, and so I see among my students, and this could be just because I'm here in the Midwest and it's very like practical minded, and mm-hmm. a lot of these students are from small towns where they really did know almost everybody that, you know, in their lives. And so in a sense, in a small town, everybody's famous, you know?
Right.
And I think then for them, they're really, it really strikes them as fake and they don't really buy into it. So one of the joys actually of teaching here at Kansas State is that I can talk about advertising and commercialization and that kind of thing. And the students have sort of a built-in skepticism already, which is kind
right.
of fun.
I'd love to see like how that would transplant to like UNLV or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good choice of place. I mean, because Vegas, I think, like Neil Postman pointed out almost 20 years ago that Vegas was now the symbol of America. You know, it's no longer the Statue of Liberty. It's like
right.
Las Vegas has become that symbol.
I could talk to you about this subject for the next 2 hours, but I should probably move on. You've worked a lot in multimedia, in YouTube videos, in creating media that isn't just the printed word. How do you see this fitting into this future of scholarly communication and publishing? Do you think that these experiments you do with video and social networking are going to remain sort of your lab that's complementary to your written research, or do you think they will become credible research articles in themselves? What do you think of the future of multimedia in scholarly publishing?
That's a good question. I think just in the last 2 years that I've been really involved in this, I've actually seen tremendous rise in the credibility of my video work, in the sense that I think it gets engaged on a deeper level over time. And that's been really rewarding. I think that video across the disciplines is actually becoming more respectable, but it does often have to coexist with the written word. But there are now sites, for example, science journals that are encouraging, and I'm not sure if they require it yet, but definitely encouraging short video summaries of the main results, as well as the, you know, it's perfect, video is perfect for scientific experimentation, where you can actually show the video of the experiments being performed, and I think you're going to see more of that happening.
So visualization of data is going to become
yeah,
more
but I think though that the more exciting thing is the way that video is really a different language than writing, and it certainly, as somebody who practices both, I can sense that it brings out different insights depending on which medium you're working in, which one you're working toward. So if I approach a project thinking of trying to create a visual of it, I actually think through the issues in a very different way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just exciting for expanding our discourse, not just in terms of who we reach, but also in the types of insights we come to. I think thinking visually is a very powerful method if you've been stuck in text for a long time. And we all, as scholars, engaged in text quite a bit. It's really exciting to step out and think in this new language. And I just think that more than anything is the exciting thing of where this is all going.
Yeah, and what I find interesting is that even though we've had filmmaking around for decades, it seems that in terms of preparing students for digital fluency, that we're really in the infancy of digital storytelling.
Yeah, definitely. And there are so many ways to state that we're just in the infancy, but the obvious one is just in the technology itself is becoming so much easier and more widely available. And gosh, I've been editing video actually for quite a while. And when I started, it would take days to do what it takes me just seconds to do right now. You know, just in terms of something as simple as panning and zooming and adding this effect here and layering and that kind of stuff. You know, the same thing that took days now takes minutes. And what it does, though, is really opens up your creativity to explore and try all these different techniques and ways of expressing yourself. And that's where it gets really exciting.
You are one of the most active practitioners of teaching in the cloud. And I'm wondering what opportunities for learning are enabled in this model. And could you comment on how teaching in the cloud might foster collaborative learning and collective intelligence?
Yeah. So I often like to think of this quote from Kevin Kelly, who says, "Nobody is as smart as everybody." And that kind of hangs in my head every time I go into a classroom. And I just look at the classroom, I look at the students, I start to think about who they are. Throughout the semester, I learn more and more about who they are. And it becomes increasingly evident to me, the more I get to know them, that if I can somehow harness all the intelligence and life experiences that they have, they are collectively much smarter than I am alone. So then the goal becomes trying to harness all of that. And I think that I finally sort of found the secret sauce, or you might, whatever you want to say. And it's very simple stuff. It basically just comes down to, like, the first step is I approach the students as collaborators, co-producers, co-researchers, whatever you want to call them, not as students. So you take away that hierarchy. Although I still maintain that, you know, I'm the most experienced in the bunch and sort of the expert learner, expert researcher, you might say, in the bunch. But they are also have skills to bring to the table, and it's important to recognize those. And that facilitates a feeling of empowerment among them. And I try to harness that from the very beginning, pointing out to them that whatever we do is going to contribute to the real world. Like, we're not just going to, like, be hiding behind the classroom walls and doing our own thing. We're going to contribute something to the real world. Then we start to brainstorm together. What does the world need from us? What can we do? And, you know, given the topic at hand, we start mining the literature, trying to find holes in the literature or debates in the literature, things that we can help resolve, some way that we can contribute to the discourse. And the main point is just to say that we do it, you know, that it's all about the doing of it. And while we're doing this, like, while we're going out and researching together and learning together and all these things, it's almost like the learning happens sort of accidentally. You know, it's kind of weird to say, but it really struck me the other day when we were in class. And we spent the whole class, like we do every class, just on the edge of our seats. Everybody's leaning forward, brainstorming, trying to solve various problems in our current project that we're working on. Everybody's deeply engaged in all of it. And then at the end of the class, somebody mentioned, "Isn't it funny that we get 3 credits for this?" Like, I go into this classroom thinking, this is an exciting research group. We're doing really exciting research right now. It is a class, and yet you almost just totally forget that it's a class.
I think that speaks to a certain sort of naturalism to the learning. You know,
that's exactly what it's about, right? It's sort of when it's completely real and relevant and what we're doing matters, the learning becomes authentic and natural, and it's just so much fun to do that. It creates an environment in which the students themselves are thinking about harnessing collective intelligence, because they also recognize their peers as collaborators and they want to harness that. So this is an example of a little thing we did. In the first week, we recognized that, okay, if we're going to study anonymity online, we need to know everything we can about it. We need to know what's been written about it. We need to know all the literature. And so what we did is we just decided that each of us would go read 5 articles, summarize them, and upload those summaries into a database. So we did this using some free software from Zoho Creator. Just a real simple form that we created. All the students went out, read 5 articles. We had 16 students. So in the end, we should have had, you know, 80 articles or so, but we ended up with 94 because some students found more than 5. Then one of the students just wanted to create a better way to read these summaries. So he took the feed from this database that was created and created a totally new display system for it. Using Ajax and all sorts of interesting stuff.
Wow.
And so within 5 days, these students had created an entirely new database system for harvesting articles on anonymity. In addition, all students had read 5 articles, summarized them, and also read the summaries of all the other students, so that when they walked into the classroom, all the students were familiar with 94 articles in the field. And that's a very different platform to start from than just going in cold and saying, okay, we're going to study anonymity this semester, and your first assignment is this article, and they all come back and they've read one article. You know,
I think that's this is amazing, because it's such a simple idea. I mean, the simple idea is that why not structure classes so that there's a goal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The purpose-driven class is a fairly rare thing, and it seems to drive students' interest to natural learning by larger proportions.
Yeah, and then the fun of teaching and the sort of the art of teaching becomes less about how to deliver information and more about how to help students find a purpose that matters.
Right.
And then pursuing that purpose. And that's what we do anyway. Like, that's what we do not only in our work, but when we're living our best, you know.
One small question related to this, just to play devil's advocate.
Okay.
When you talk about collective intelligence, it seems like you tend to work in groups an awful lot. Students work as a team. How do you do individual assessment? Let's say you have a student that's fairly lazy. I mean, possibly. How does he out himself, in other words?
Yeah. Well, I think that's, to me, the art of collaboration is exactly like trying to find that balance between individual responsibility and somehow then also finding a way to leverage all the individual contributions in a way that the end point is greater than the sum of its parts, you know. And the way I do that is the sort of secret behind it all is that while it looks like group work, every student has their own very specific role and assignment in that group. And a lot of that is actually self-constructed so that they are sort of developing their own project within the larger project. And that sort of self-guided piece creates more motivation and also ultimately creates a better product because they know better than I do what their expertise is and how they can contribute. But ultimately, then in all of my projects, there is an individually graded piece. So in the case of the anonymity project, every student keeps their own research blog. All of those are aggregated into a single feed that anybody can check out on our, and we have like a research hub. But ultimately, every student also has their own blog. And so I can go there and I can, it becomes like a learning diary. You know, like I can actually see what they've learned and what they've contributed over time. Same thing on the wiki. You know, the wiki is a collaborative thing, but the wiki also tracks exactly what every individual contributes. And then also, and the final video that we'll create will be a 50-minute documentary, but made up of 16 projects, each one of which will be about 5 minutes long. Each one will be individually graded. And then I'll just take the best or the most relevant to create the final 50-minute documentary of it. So every student has an individual path that they're walking while at the same time contributing to the whole.
Well, I've got one last question for you. Just your opinion. In an age of budget cuts and hiring freezes and general belt tightening, how do you see teaching and learning reacting to the shift in economics we're seeing? Does a lack of funding encourage or discourage innovation?
You know, there's something that's happening right now. Let's talk about what's happening right now. Right now, in the short term, there is this panic phase. And just about every department I can think of, people I've talked to around campus, are worried about cuts and what might happen. And this creates a immediate desire to make your program look better than the others so that you're not the one who gets cut, right? So like, if we're talking like at a faculty level, what are faculty doing to address the budget crunch? I'd say the first thing they're doing is trying to make themselves look good and make their departments look good. And that is actually playing out in some ways in a race for majors, because the more majors your department has, the safer you are if you're concerned about your department being cut. But all of this is actually playing out in a much broader field that I don't know if everybody's fully aware of, but I think certainly administrators are aware of this. And that's a broader field of competition against people like, or institutions like Kaplan University. I don't know if you saw the video they just put out.
I haven't.
You'll have to see it. It's very jarring, and it has the uncle in Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and he plays a professor in this 1 minute YouTube clip. He's in this huge lecture hall, 200, 300 people or so, and he says, "I come before you today to apologize." You know, all the students are dazed at first, and then they all look up and they say, "Oh, this is interesting." You know, and he goes on and he says, "We failed you. We've all failed you." And he said, the whole system has failed you. It's time for a new system. And as he talks, suddenly you go from the lecture hall and then you see his face on a screen being transported onto a Mac computer on a subway next to somebody else who's sitting there with their iPod listening to the same lecture. And it just goes on and on to show you all the new ways that lecture content can be distributed. And then the last line is Kaplan University, like, we understand your life and right. we're going to adapt to your life, that kind of thing. So here you have Kaplan University, who can easily offer a four-year degree at a very cheap rate, although my understanding is it's not as cheap as it could be. But, you know, they're not paying the building overhead, all that type of stuff. Any online school can do that. So I think there's a certain fear that online classes in a budget crunch situation could become more popular, and especially sort of grabbing people who need to or want to work while going to school and maybe are in situations where it's not easy to get to a campus. You know, all the reasons why online education is flourishing, I think, are only going to be magnified in this environment. So I think that becomes yet another challenge. Now, in the meantime, I think, though, that if we're truly sort of racing for majors, the upside of this is that it forces us to become more student-centered. And the most successful will be those who do this in a way that's not sort of crude and cheaply done, but in a way that truly recognizes students as mature and capable judges of the quality of their education. I think a lot of people, you know, if they're thinking about catering to students, they think about edutainment, you know, sort of like the lowest, crudest forms of entertainment right. disguised education, right? But the reality is that most students see right through that stuff and they want a good education. So I think that hopefully this will create a trend that will, and of course, it's just like maybe like hopes running wild, but I would hope that it would create a trend in which people, first of all, recognize students as mature and capable judges of the quality of their education, and then secondly, adapting in a way that creates a better learning environment that excites the students and gets them involved in, like we've discussed before, creates this sort of purpose-driven or goal-driven education. I guess I like purpose-driven better than goal-driven, you know,
yeah.
The sort of idea of regaining a sense of purpose in education. That would be the best case scenario. Right. And the beauty of it in today's environment is that a lot of the tools that can be leveraged to do this are free. And if you look at our operating budget for digital ethnography, this is an entity now that has produced videos that have been seen by over 14 million people or something like that. And, you know, translated in 15 languages all over the world. And our operating budget is exactly $0. That's just the way things are today. You can do so much just by leveraging all the free stuff that's out there.
So it sounds like the danger is commodifying education too much to make it a almost fast food education.
Yeah, I think that would be certainly something to be wary of. And right. we can all battle that situation just by creating real and powerful and significant learning opportunities for our students that they will immediately recognize as significant as well.
Thanks, Michael Wesch, for your time. Thanks a lot, man.
All right. Thank you.
An interview with Michael Wesch, Assistant Professor of Cultural Anthropology at Kansas State University. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.